Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh, it is Friday, June 30th, 2017. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along for this legislative wind-down holiday edition of the program. Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation is here, as is Rob Schofield from the liberal North Carolina Justice Center. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Jeff.
So after 5.5 months, the legislature has wrapped up its long legislative session, kind of, sort of. This week, lawmakers voted to override the governor's budget veto, as expected, surprised us by pursuing impeachment against the Secretary of State. Early this morning, a stalemate between the two chambers on energy, it ended. The House gets loosening of some solar regulations. The Senate gets an 18-month ban on wind farms. Becky, why is this policy significant? And from each of you, what do you make of it?
Well, the policy is significant because energy, how we get energy, what energy cost affects every part of every North Carolinian's life, every business. It affects state government because state government has to pay the electric bill in all the universities, the schools, the buildings, all of that. So energy is a big deal. And all of these policy changes, particularly those that impact the cost and the access of energy, is important. And think, too, as a recruiting tool for North Carolina to get businesses to come here. If we're going to reinvent and revitalize our rural areas, we're recruiting manufacturing facilities. One of the first things they have to look at is what are the energy costs. So this is a big deal. The last time we had a big comprehensive energy policy change was in 2007. Here we are in 2017, which is sort of the next reiteration of this. So if we're only going to do this every 10 years and it has really big impact on the cost and the accessibility of energy, that's why this is such a big deal and we need to pay attention to it.
And of course, I would say it's a big deal because we're talking about the survival of the species and survival of the planet. The legislature and in North Carolina in general has been dragging its feet on moving in the direction of renewable energy. We need to ramp it up at triple the rate we're going right now. This is a nonsensical idea of putting a moratorium on wind farms. We've already had the military weigh in and say it doesn't cause any possible problems for our military installations. We need to go forward with this. We need to be aggressively moving to install and transition our economy to a green, renewable energy system. And the happy thing about this is that the reports and studies show that this will actually benefit the economy. It will be good for rural areas. It will be good for economic development. And most importantly, it will be good for our air and our water and our survival.
For context, we should note the moratorium would block two projects that are already in development. Those are not grandfathered in. There's no carve-out for those. So an interesting development that broke early this morning, Friday, at the legislature. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, a House panel began efforts to establish an investigation of Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. Republican House Rep. Chris Millis says that she has broken state and federal laws for issuing public notaries to undocumented residents. Marshall calls this a political attack. This committee could lead to impeachment hearings. Rob, dangerous precedent, necessary action, just the next step in these partisan times?
I think it's maybe all of the above. It is a terribly disturbing development. Impeachment is something that should be done, you know, truly as a last resort for someone who is violating law or to their own benefit. This is a dispute over interpreting a law, interpreting a statute, over how to issue notary licenses. It's a minor, obscure issue that Secretary Marshall had already discussed with the legislature earlier this year. To move down the road toward impeachment opens the Pandora's box. I mean, what the heck? An audit this week found that the agriculture commissioner has not been doing dairy inspections properly. Should we impeach him? The legislature has passed all kinds of unconstitutional laws. Should we impeach them? It's a ridiculous and unprecedented. We've never done anything like this in modern times in North Carolina. And I think the editorials have been just scathing in recent days. And I think the legislature will back down eventually on this.
Becky, last impeachment in the state, Governor William Holden 147 years ago.
I think it's important to note that this commission, this discussion that we had at the General Assembly this week, involves an investigation that could lead to an impeachment. These are not impeachment proceedings or procedures in any way. So let's not jump ahead to the accusation that these are impeachment proceedings, because they're not. It's an investigation. Now, having said that, and these allegations that Representative Chris Mellis has brought against Secretary of State Elaine Marshall, you know, I mean, it's a pretty serious thing, and I think that it absolutely should be investigated. My question is this the right way to go about it? If an elected official has broken the law, it seems to me that the better direction to go would be to let our law enforcement officials and, you know, those people handle that investigation. If there is so much distrust between the General Assembly and, say, the Attorney General's office or those investigative people that we have to do that, then maybe we need to address that problem. So I think this is I think that an investigation into, you know, someone breaking the law, an elected official, is certainly a legitimate thing. I think that our law enforcement officers are the ones who are better equipped to handle that.
No indication that there is a criminal investigation underway by any law enforcement agency. Speaker Tim Moore told us last night that they have contacted an independent prosecutor, and to what extent this moves forward, we shall see. But it is unprecedented in modern political times.
I absolutely agree with you. And again, I would go back. I think this needs to be unwound a bit. And, you know, if there are allegations that warrant a further investigation, I think that we should turn it over to our law enforcement officers. And again, if there's a problem there, then we need to address that problem.
One final thing to touch on here is the nature of our legislature. They adjourned about 2:15 this morning. They'll be back in early August. They'll be back in September. They'll be back to do overrides. They'll be back to draw maps at some point. At what point do we need to start having the conversation about moving to a full-time legislature, or at least carving out some times where it's clear when there will be breaks?
I think we need to move in that direction. This is what we've seen with these special sessions that we've had in recent years is that there's almost no process involved. We don't know what's happening. They are sprung on people. They just sort of show up and start doing stuff. They've been negotiating stuff in the interim weeks. I think it would be beneficial to everyone if we acknowledge the fact that we're a large and growing state, soon to be, the seventh largest state in the country. We've got a part-time legislature where we're paying these folks some piddling sum of money. We need to get more serious about our government. I think it's time to be more serious about the structure of when our sessions take place.
I agree with Robin. I think that broad issue needs to be discussed and debated and some decisions made along that way. From a pragmatic standpoint, though, Jeff, you mentioned they're coming back vetoes of the whatever they would consider vetoes that the governor has made. When the General Assembly is not in session, the governor has 30 days with which to either sign a bill into law to veto it, or if he does nothing after the 30 days, then it automatically becomes law. This session on August 3rd is 33 days after, you know, they have adjourned, and they've sent all of those bills over at, what'd you say, 2:30 in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
So he has that amount of time. I think that's why they set the special session coming up. That's why they did it. And then also, don't forget, we've got this redistricting that's out there. We're waiting for the courts to come back and say what we need to do with redrawing those legislative districts.
I think we already know what they need to do. They need to draw fair constitutional districts, and I think they could have done that during the regular session. But I agree that we need to get more serious about how we plan these special sessions. They just get sprung. They get scheduled with no particular rhyme or reason, and I think that's not serving our democracy well.
You are listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. Becky Gray from the John Locke Foundation is here. Also, Rob Schofield, Director of Research at NC Policy Watch. Let's continue this conversation about the legislative sessions. There were five special sessions or extra sessions in 2016. We're expecting at least two this year. By my estimation, money, there are going to be more. There's going to be, we know maps are going to be drawn. We expect constitutional amendments to come in at least several of them. I expect voter ID to emerge at some point, and there are going to be overrides. Is there, I've heard from lawmakers on the right and left who don't like this flow because they do have jobs and they do have families and they do have vacations, and many of them don't live within 20 or 30 minutes of the legislature. Do either of you have ideas about how to to better schedule or better do this? Or is it okay the way the timing of this works?
Well, North Carolina is only one of 11 states that does not have session limits. Hmm. So it's not just this uncertainty of the special sessions, the regular session, we don't know what it's going to be. And Jeff, you know, it is very difficult to plan. It is very difficult to get candidates to run for these seats when there's so much uncertainty. As you mentioned, people have jobs, they have families, they have other obligations. I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, I couldn't tell my boss I'm going to be leaving in January and I'll be back sometime. Please keep my job right. open for me. And when they come here, it is a part-time legislature, but I'm telling you, as we know, particularly this week, I mean, it isn't just full-time work, it is way more than full-time work.
Rob, coming to you in a second, doesn't that kill any ability to have professional diversity in this body? I mean, a lot of lawyers, a lot of retired folks, a lot of self-made or inherited millionaires. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but there are not teachers or shift managers, or there aren't a lot of regular
or
folks
reporters.
In that building. Sure,
there you know, or think tank people.
Sure,
it does. It prohibits a lot of people from doing it, and it's not just the money. I mean, as Rob mentioned earlier, they don't get paid very much for a rank and file legislator. It's what $13,000-$14,000. Now they get mileage and some per diem and all those kind of things. But
to be fair, they do have to have
so
a place
it's
to
not
rest their
just,
head here.
It's not exactly. I'm not complaining about
right.
any of that at
right.
all. I mean, I think they ought to be paid more if we're going to expect this of them. But, you know, you get into a balance, too, because if you really restrict the time that they're here and those kind of things, then it puts more pressure on professional staff who are unelected. So it's really it's not an easy solution to come about.
One thing I think we should talk about in addition, I agree. I think we need to pay them more. I think they need to be. We need to make it so that people who are regular folks can serve in government, and that's just not the case right now. Another easy way or important way to advance that cause, and we were moving in this direction a decade ago in North Carolina, is public financing for elections. It's in addition to the just impossibility of serving for so many people because of the time demands and the fact that the session goes on forever. It's just bloody expensive to run for office. It's prohibitively expensive for an average person. Again, we have millionaires, as you allude to, sort of self-financing their campaigns, or people who are willing to sell their souls to super rich plutocrats who will just come in and finance their campaigns, or indeed sell their souls to the leadership of the two houses that have raised the money to finance the campaigns for the individuals. But the best possible way that would actually make it possible for regular folks to actually run for office. We've tried this in North Carolina. It actually worked when we did it for some Council of State offices, is to have public financing, to have voter-owned elections in which you make a demonstration that you're a qualified person, you get enough signatures or something to that effect, and then you qualify for public funding. It's a tiny little amount of money in the big state budget, but it makes a huge difference in giving voters control of their democracy and taking it away from the wealthy 1% who are basically running our elections right now.
I won't name names. I do want to paint, a brief picture. There have been a couple of times this session, you know, a longer legislative day ends. I'm heading home. It's 6:30. It's 7 o'clock. And I've encountered this with a Republican and with a Democrat, just in the hallways and said, hey, see you later. Have a nice night. Heading home? No, I got to go make a couple hours of calls. Got to go raise money. And that's something I would own that. I'm guilty of not reporting, spending a ton of time reporting that. But that is a huge dynamic in this. And there are members in that legislature who are there largely because they are so good at fundraising, right? I mean, they generate enough money for the caucus that they have the support of the caucus. It doesn't necessarily matter.
Right. But don't forget, too, I mean, that money comes from people, from individuals who want to support, who voluntarily want to support a particular candidate. I'll be honest with you, I don't like the public financing. I don't think that we as taxpayers should be compelled to support candidates that we may vehemently disagree with our tax money. I think that individuals ought to be able to make those decisions. Now, maybe we need to look at our campaign finance laws to make it more transparent, more open. I mean, that's what I would advocate for. I would go the other way of allowing people to raise money, but have every bit of it be transparent and open. In this day and age with the internet, with things being posted, I think that, you know, when you get campaign contributions, Jeff, if you're running for office, I ought to know who's giving you money, how much it's come from.
Sure, there's too much dark money.
But, of course, yeah, I mean, the money doesn't all go to the candidates. It goes to these committees and these PACs and these hit groups that come in that are anonymous in the last month. And nobody's figured out a good way to keep an eye on that. And if you're talking about giving money to campaigns, it's, you know, there's lots of things that government does that I vehemently oppose, that you vehemently oppose. But it's not that we're investing per se in individual candidates when we have public financing. We're investing in the whole process. We're investing in our democracy. And I just think that would move us so much, such a better direction away from the system we've got right now, which is literally being controlled by a handful of billionaires and millionaires who basically own our elections.
We've moved closer to a plutocracy in some ways, have we not, when we think about campaign finance?
Yes, absolutely. It's both liberal plutocrats and conservative plutocrats. We've got a handful of people at the national and the state level who have enormous outsized influence that's well beyond their, you know, they're one citizen, but they have the influence of a 100,000 citizens when it comes to deciding who's going to be a candidate, who's going to get elected.
I disagree with that. I see this really as a free speech, First Amendment right, being able to exercise that, you as an individual. You know, and I also kind of argue with this whole thing of that elections can be bought. I think that's insulting to voters. I think it's insulting to individual voters. I mean, you know, I would just ask you, you know, Rob, I mean, how much money would it have taken for you to vote for Donald Trump?
Well, obviously, I'm an exception.
There's enough money in the world.
That's my point.
But of course, you know that money makes an enormous difference. You can't sit here and say that,
well,
that
you
money
need to
doesn't
get
make
your,
an enormous difference.
You need to get your message out, of course, as a candidate.
Right,
I mean, I think that's important. But, you know, here's the other thing, too. I think it's important to remember that as voters, we have responsibilities as well to know who those candidates are, what they stand for, who is best going to reflect our values and what we want done in office, so that when we go, whether it's voting for a city councilman or whether it's voting for the president of the United States. You know, I think this whole idea that campaigns can be bought and those, I just think it's first of all, it's a First Amendment free speech
issue. Nobody's saying you can't spend money.
No.
Nobody's saying that people can't make contributions.
No, it's whose money are you going to spend?
Absolutely, but nobody's saying that the plutocrats can't continue to give money to their candidates. We're just saying that other people who don't have the favor of plutocrats ought to be able to have an adequate amount of money to run a decent campaign themselves. And the reality is, what is it, a third, a half of the districts in North Carolina? We don't even have competitive races. We don't even have more than one candidate. And that's partially
because of money.
Partially because the districts are gerrymandered.
But I also heard you say you want campaign finance reform, and it's also a free speech issue.
Mm-hmm.
How do those two things work together? Isn't there a pretty clear line there?
Well, I think that, I mean, what I'm talking about, you know, with free speech, free speech ought to be open and it ought to be transparent.
Speech or are we using money as a vehicle for speech?
It's both. If I give you money as a candidate, I am exercising my free speech rights.
There are actually very compelling arguments made by conservative litigants and constitutional theorists that anonymous speech is an important First Amendment right as well. And so it's a very complicated area. It would be nice if we could just say, wave a magic wand and say all political campaign contributions will be transparent, we'll know whoever. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen in our lifetimes that's going to be the case. So,
but I think it's a dangerous road that we go down when we look to government to fix that, to run elections. I think that's extremely dangerous to go in.
The government has any more important function than running free and fair elections. That's what the government does. That's the nature of democracy.
Who should run elections then?
Well, when I say run elections, of course, the government has a responsibility, and I think it's a core function of government. I think we would all agree with that, to set up the process, you know, where we go to vote, the precinct system that we have, the dates of when you file to run for office, what the requirements are for running. I mean, a lot of that's set out in our Constitution. I think that clearly is a function of government. And then back off and let us find candidates to run, let us as voters vet those candidates, talk about issues, ask the questions, hold public forums, all of those, contribute to candidates that we want to do. So the government sets the framework, and it needs to be clearly set and fair. I mean, I will argue that, and I think Rob would agree with that. And then let voters and let the process work, let the free speech and the First Amendment take over from there.
We're going to move from campaign finance to redistricting, and these are, you know, on some level threaded together. This week at the legislature, there was another effort to redistrict local boundaries. This time in Asheville, there are six city council seats and a mayor, all of whom are Democrats. We've heard from some Republicans going back several terms now, heard it from the former Senate Rules Chair Tom Apodaca, concerns about South Asheville not being represented. And this is one of the less blue, perhaps reddish areas of Asheville. If we're being honest, Asheville is a pretty blue spot in the state. But the effort from conservatives to redistrict Asheville, they say, is largely because South Asheville has been unrepresented. Also because half of the city council members live very close to each other in Asheville. So that's a little of the context. But this has failed in the past. It moved forward this past week. And a Republican in the Senate, Chuck Edwards, wanted the support of someone in the local delegation. Pretty much everybody else in the local delegation is a Democrat, if memory serves. So he sought the support of Brian Turner, who's a Democrat in the House. Turner said, I'll give you the support so long as the maps are drawn by an independent redistricting commission. So Chuck McGrady, a Republican, ran the amendment stood up in support of the amendment. And the House voted overwhelmingly for this. So the North Carolina House went on record on Tuesday as being in support of independent redistricting.
A bipartisan vote, I might add.
A largely bipartisan vote. Holy, you bleep it out. They objected to third reading because I think they realized what they had just done, or somebody told them what they had just done. We're getting in the weeds a little bit here, but we've talked plenty about redistricting. We've talked about independent redistricting. The House voted for it this week. They then, of course, later stripped it out a couple days later and gave Asheville the option to use an independent redistricting commission. What did you make of that? Is that significant?
It's another example of how the rhetoric doesn't match up with what actually gets done. I mean, the House has actually voted for this before. I think when Tom Tillis was Speaker, I think they voted for independent redistricting on a statewide level, which
they
is
did.
Something.
And then it died in the Senate,
right, which
that's
is
before
and
my
it's
time.
Something
okay.
that Phil Berger went before he was the Senate majority leader, spent pro tem, sponsored several times when he was in the minority. So it's funny how it works. You get in power, and all of a sudden the idea of independent redistricting seems a little less attractive because you kind of like being able to draw the maps yourself. I think this Asheville situation was just the latest in a long series of incidents we've seen over the last several years where the Conservative General Assembly has looked at liberal cities with maps that they don't like, and they've tried to interpose and put themselves, it's happened in Greensboro, it's happened in Wake County, where they've tried to redraw the maps because they don't like the local officials drawing the maps because they don't like the results. It would have been a wonderful development if we could have gotten our foot in the door with the independent redistricting, because that's something that I think Becky and I both agree is absolutely necessary, but unfortunately the powers that be realized it was dangerous for them to go down that road, so they backed off.
Well, this, I think, just raises the question once again and raises the issue, which is an important one, of, you know, how do we draw these districts so that we have fair and competitive districts, but also all voters are equally represented? And what we've seen, and we've talked about this with the whole map, with the congressional districts right. divided into 13 districts. We've certainly talked and heard a lot about the legislative districts, the 50 Senate districts and the 120 House districts right. that have been litigated through the court, you know, waiting for Supreme Court decisions on all of that. But this is also happening at the local level. And I think the situation in Asheville, Jeff, you're exactly right. It was a very interesting exchange. But this is also happening in Greensboro. It's happening in Raleigh. It's happening in these cities and larger counties across the state.
Some
and it's something we need to pay attention
court,
but to.
Yes.
But, you know, think about it this way. I mean, if you just, Asheville's a good example of that. Wake County and Raleigh is a good example of that. There are blue areas that tend to be in the heavily dense urban, packed, mm-hmm. sort of packed into the urban areas. There are also then out in the more suburban areas, there are more, tend to be more conservative voters. So the way that you draw those districts, if you have at-large districts in your within your city limits, then, you know, what you're going to get is areas that are not represented. So this redistricting effort is to ensure that those voters who live in the suburban areas are represented as well. How do you do that? And I think it's unfortunate, and I think it is a real impediment to the discussion and moving forward when the immediate reaction is Democrats versus Republicans. I think that Rob and I have worked together on this, that really what the discussion needs to be is how do we make sure that all of our citizens within our city limits are equally represented and everyone's voice is heard. But that's a hard discussion to have when politics and the partisan advantage is what is foremost in those discussions.
Well, and I think it's worth noting that the Republicans have not been, who run the General Assembly, have not been targeting any conservative areas for redrawing their maps. They've only targeted large urban areas that tend to be Democratic. And I mean, it's really pretty blatantly political.
Those in power have long been opposed to this. Whoever's in power doesn't want to do it.
I think Democrats did, and I mean, I think that will change.
Though,
right. I am tired of the thing. Well, you know, they did it, so now this group gets to do it when they get in. But this is not unique to one party or the other.
Year that ends in a nine might be the year that we see somebody who is in power staring down the pipe, painting on the wall of, all right, we might not be in power in a year or two. That might be when the party in power relinquishes map drawing control. We certainly will see in the years to come. We'll end on a lighter one. We do this on the podcast sometimes, just silly throwaway questions. This is not that silly. 4th of July weekend, if you're going to a barbecue, if you're heading to some fun potluck, two meats or two main dishes, two sides, and a drink. What are you going with? And if you need a second to think about it, I can offer mine up.
Go for it.
I'd go with some grilled chicken,
yeah,
a cheeseburger, fruit salad.
Wow.
Can I do mac and cheese? That's so gluttonous. Mac and cheese.
It.
My wife's a PA in weight loss surgery. She might not be pleased with the mac and cheese answer, but those four and some sort of beer. Nothing too heavy if it's a hot sunny day. What are you reaching for this weekend?
I like barbecue. I like North Carolina Eastern barbecue, but lately my wife and I have been experimenting with these awesome stuffed turkey burgers I've been making. With it's got sort of an Italian stuffing. Sometimes even make it work with veggie burgers for my friends who are vegetarians. Got to have some baked beans, fries.
Baked beans. I knew I was missing something.
Yeah. Got to have those essentials. And, yeah, some good dark beer.
That's on my second plate.
All right, I'm going to go with grilled chicken or grilled salmon. Mm. Any kind of fish is my favorite in the summer.
You go to fancy barbecues, grilled salmon.
Also, one of my regular haunts during the summer is the farmer's market. So I kind of go out and get whatever is there right now, tomatoes, watermelon, the peaches are coming in, the corn is fabulous. And so I'm not a vegetarian, but I go much more that way in the summer with all these things. And peach cobbler, and I also do make the best baked beans, which my family will tell you. So that's got to be part of the mix.
Wow, that's a bold statement right there. All right, Becky Gray from the John Locke Foundation, Rob Schofield from NC Policy Watch, thanks both for being here and having an extended conversation on the podcast.
Jeff, thank you. Thanks. Happy 4th of July.
Back at you.
Remember, you can hear a shorter version of this conversation weekdays at 4:50. That's Fridays at 4:50 on WUNC. Subscribe to the podcast. Of course, share it with your friends and colleagues. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and catch all the political news as it develops throughout the week at our website, WUNC.org. For Rob and Becky, I'm Jeff Tabiri. Enjoy your weekend.
I'm Kamaya Truitt-Martin, host of the new WUNC Youth Podcast. On each episode, we ask the question, what is news?
It's the facts, you know, stories, interviews, I don't know.
We'll figure it out with help from public radio personalities like Al Letson and Glenn Washington.
Hey, Kamaya.
And of course, our fabulous youth reporting team.
Oh, like me, Emmanuel Tobe.
Yeah, like you. The WUNC Youth Podcast. Fresh new episodes are available now.